Welcome to the Rapid Learning Medical Review Series. Today's audio tutorial is on pharmacology. By completing this tutorial, you will learn about basic principles of pharmacology, such as pharmacodynamics and pharmacokinetics, a review of drug naming conventions. We will review pharmacology of the autonomic nervous system, as this is a major area of focus for the USMLE exam, and we will review specific drug classes. For the purposes of the USMLE Step 1 exam, you should not worry about memorizing drug dosages or trade names. Instead, focus on learning the core principles of pharmacology and the key characteristics and toxicities of representative drugs in each major class of pharmaceuticals. Now, let's get started by reviewing the core principles of pharmacodynamics. Pharmacodynamics is the study of the relationship between drug concentration in the body and the physiological response to that concentration of drug. In essence, pharmacodynamics is the study of what the drug does to the body. There are two key principles to keep in mind. First, the dose of the drug is directly linked to the magnitude of the body's response to that drug. A basic premise underlying pharmacology is that for a given dose of a drug, there will be a given biological response that is directly proportional to the given dose. The second key principle is that drugs act through receptors. Thus, it is critical to understand the types of interactions between drugs and receptors, which leads us now to a discussion of enzyme kinetics, since interactions between a drug and receptor rely on similar kinetics. An understanding of pharmacodynamics is rooted in an understanding of enzyme kinetics. Vmax is the maximum rate of reaction and is directly proportional to the enzyme concentration. Km indicates the affinity of the enzyme for the substrate in question. A lower Km indicates a higher affinity, and vice versa. When plotted on a logarithmic scale, the slope of the line equals Km divided by Vmax. The farther the x-intercept is to the left, the weaker the Km. Similarly, the higher the y-intercept, the lower the Vmax. If the two lines of two different drugs cross each other, these two drugs are competing for the same enzyme. If the two lines do not cross, then the two drugs are not competing. Now, enzyme inhibitors may be competitive or non-competitive. Competition refers to a competition between the normal substrate for the enzyme and the inhibitor in question. Competitive inhibitors will be similar to the natural substrate. They may be displaced by increasing concentrations of substrate. Competitive inhibitors will bind the active sites of the enzymes, will have no effect on Vmax, but they will increase Km. All of this is in contrast to non-competitive inhibitors, which do not resemble the substrate, are not displaced by increasing substrate concentration, and do not bind the active site. Non-competitive inhibitors will decrease, not increase, Vmax, and they have no discernible effect on Km. The action of drugs and enzymes is similar to that of drugs at their receptors. We can describe receptors as the components of a cell or organism that interact with a drug and initiate the chain of events that lead to the drug's observed effect. In this respect, they are not only important in pharmacology, but also in endocrinology, immunology, and molecular biology. In particular, receptors determine the relationship between the dose or concentration of a drug and its pharmacological effect. Receptors determine drug selectivity, and they are responsible for both agonist and antagonist activity of drugs. Coupling is the term used to describe the process that links the drug occupancy of receptors to the pharmacological response. The efficacy of coupling is determined by the initial conformational change in the receptor and in the biochemical events that transduce receptor occupancy into cellular response. Receptors are important for dose-response curves. The basic premise underlying pharmacology is that for a given dose of a drug, there will be a given biological response that is directly proportional to the given dose. Given that drugs act through receptors, the relationship between the given dose and the observed response is linked by the interaction of the drug with a specific receptor in a phenomenon called the dose response. At low doses, the effect of a drug will increase as the concentration increases in most systems. As the dose increases, the response increment reduces until a point where no more increase in drug effect is seen with an increased concentration. This is commonly referred to as the plateau. Dose response curves are very useful when examining how a drug acts in the body. As we will discuss, dose response curves provide information on the type of action the drug has at its receptor, as well as providing information on how safe a drug is at varying doses. This leads us to a discussion of agonists and antagonists. Agonists initiate changes in cell function through their actions at receptors, producing effects of various types. Agonists have a specified potency, which is the range of doses over which a chemical produces increasing responses. An agonist's potency depends upon their affinity and efficacy. Affinity is the tendency to bind to receptors, while efficacy is the ability to initiate changes once bound. The best way to illustrate the different types of actions of agonists is by comparing dose-response curves. When looking at a dose-response curve, a full agonist will produce maximum effect and has high efficacy. In contrast, a partial agonist produces a lower response at full receptor occupancy compared to full agonists, and as a result, it has intermediate efficacy. It is important to note that while a partial agonist has lower efficacy, its potency, which again is the amount needed to produce a given effect, may be higher, lower, or equal to the potency of a full agonist causing the same effect, as potency and efficacy are independent of each other. In contrast, antagonists prevent agonists from activating receptors. Antagonists are classified as reversible competitive, irreversible, or non-competitive, depending on the strength of their action at the receptor. The best way to illustrate the different types of actions of agonists is by comparing dose-response curves. The first case is that of the reversible competitive antagonists, which shift dose-response curves to the right, decrease potency, and increase the EC50. As you can tell by looking at the graph of a reversible competitive antagonist, it takes a higher concentration of agonist to overcome the effects of the antagonist, but when it does, the maximal effect is still the same as with the agonist alone. The second case is the non-competitive antagonist, which decreases efficacy of the agonist and shifts the curve downward. If you can imagine what is happening, as antagonists occupy the receptors and refuse to move, antagonists have fewer receptors they can occupy, and thus they cannot cause as great of an effect. Dose-response curves are used to measure the therapeutic index, or TI. The therapeutic index gives a relative measure of how safe a drug is. TI equals the LD50, which is the dose toxic to 50% of the population, divided by the ED50, which is the dose effective in 50% of the population. This can be memorized using the abbreviation TILE, T-I-L-E, for TI equals LD50 divided by ED50. Safer drugs have higher therapeutic index values. In summary, pharmacodynamics is the study of what the drug does to the body. There are two key principles to keep in mind. First, the dose of the drug is directly linked to the magnitude of the body's response to that drug. And second, it is important to remember that drugs act through receptors. Now, let's review key principles of pharmacokinetics. The word pharmacokinetics is derived from Greek root words. Pharmakon means drug, and kinetikos means putting into motion. Thus, pharmacokinetics is the study of the movement of drugs in the body. Why is pharmacokinetics important? How the body handles drugs determines 1. How fast the drug starts to work, which is its onset of action, 2. How well the drug works, or its effectiveness, and 3. How long the drug works, or its duration of action. These parameters determine the dose of the drug, the route of administration, and the frequency of dosing of the drug. Pharmacokinetics can often be understood using the abbreviation ADME. A stands for absorption, D for distribution, M stands for metabolism, and E for excretion. These are the four phases that constitute pharmacokinetics. An important concept of pharmacokinetics is the volume of distribution. The volume of distribution is a proportionality constant that relates the total amount of drug in the body to the concentration of drug in plasma, and typically is described in units of liters or liters per kilogram of body. This calculation is made possible by the assumption that the body is a single unit where changes that occur in the plasma reflect proportional changes in tissue chemical concentrations. The volume of distribution for drugs bound by plasma proteins may be affected when a patient has liver or kidney disease. The volume of distribution, or V sub D, is calculated by dividing the amount of drug in the body by the plasma drug concentration. If the VD is low, around 4 to 8 liters, this indicates a drug that distributes in the blood. Moderate VD distributes in body water or the extracellular space, and a high volume of distribution that exceeds body weight is also distributed to the tissues. Clearance describes the rate of chemical elimination from the body in terms of the volume of fluid containing the chemical that is cleared per unit of time. Thus, clearance has the units of flow, that is, milliliters per minute. Clearance is useful because it relates the rate of elimination to the plasma concentration. Clearance is calculated by dividing the rate of drug elimination by the plasma drug concentration. Clearance can also be determined by multiplying the volume of distribution by Ke, where Ke is the elimination constant for that drug. If you calculate the volume of distribution and the rate of clearance using known data, then it is easy to determine the half-life of the chemical, which is the time required for the blood or plasma chemical concentration to decrease to one-half its original value due to elimination. Calculating the half-life is useful because it allows for direct comparisons between different chemicals in terms of how long each chemical can be expected to stay in the body. Half-life is determined using the formula 0.7 times volume of distribution divided by clearance. A drug infused at a constant rate will reach the following plasma concentrations per half-life. One half-life will reach 50% of the concentration. Two half-lives, 75%. Three half-lives, 87.5%. And four half-lives will reach 93.75%. Now, with calculating dose, there are two dose calculations you must know: the loading dose and the maintenance dose. The loading dose is the initial higher dose used at the beginning of a treatment to rapidly achieve therapeutic levels. The maintenance dose is the quantity of drug required to sustain desired therapeutic levels in the blood or tissue. Loading dose is calculated by multiplying the target plasma concentration, which is abbreviated CP, the volume of distribution, divided by bioavailability, which is represented by the letter F. Maintenance dose is calculated by multiplying the target plasma concentration by clearance divided by bioavailability. Bioavailability has a maximum value of 1, which is reached when a drug is given intravenously. If a patient has impaired liver or kidney function, this will affect dosages, since the liver is the primary site of metabolism and the kidneys the primary site of elimination. In this case, the loading dose remains the same, but the maintenance dose is decreased to compensate for decreased ability of the body to metabolize and eliminate the drug. Zero-order elimination refers to elimination that remains at a constant rate, irrespective of the amount of drug in the body. In zero-order kinetics, a constant amount of drug is eliminated per unit time in a linear fashion. Examples of zero-order kinetics can be remembered using the abbreviation PEA, or P. This stands for phenytoin, ethanol, and aspirin at toxic concentrations. When graphing time versus plasma concentration, zero-order elimination is linear. First-order kinetics, on the other hand, occurs when the rate of elimination is proportional to the drug concentration, such that a constant fraction of a drug, such as 10% of the amount in the body, is eliminated per unit time. Thus, plasma concentration decreases exponentially over time, such that the graph of time versus plasma concentration is a curve. Elimination via the kidneys is strongly influenced by the degree of ionization of the molecule. In general, species that are ionized get trapped, while non-ionized molecules are absorbed back into the body in the renal tubules. Weak acids are ionized in basic environments, and weak bases are trapped in acidic environments, because in both cases the molecules are ionized. An easy way to remember this is that species which are weak are easily trapped by their opposite, acid versus base and base versus acid. A weak acid can be made non-ionized with bicarbonate, and a weak base by ammonium chloride, making it easier to eliminate these drugs in cases of overdose. Now let's talk about the M in ADME, which is metabolism. Biotransformation is the metabolic conversion of endogenous and xenobiotic chemicals to more polar, water-soluble compounds. When a compound is more water-soluble, it is more easily excreted from the body in the urine or feces. Biotransformation typically involves chemical modification of the original compound, called the parent compound, such that the activity of the parent compound is often decreased after biotransformation. The word biotransformation is often used interchangeably with the word metabolism. Biotransformation is, by definition, a process that is catalyzed by specific enzymes. Metabolism can be divided into two stages, phase 1 and phase 2. Phase 1 metabolism involves the enzymatic alteration of the parent compound into a more polar compound through oxidation, reduction, or hydrolysis. Typical phase 1 reactions are reduction, oxidation, and hydrolysis, with cytochrome P450 the most common phase 1 enzyme. Phase 2 metabolism adds a large, highly polar, water-soluble functional group in a process called conjugation that further aids in excretion from the body. Typical phase 2 reactions are acetylation, glucuronidation, and sulfation. Usually, phase 1 must occur before phase 2 in order to add a functional group to the compound for the phase 2 enzyme to act upon, although in some cases, phase 2 is the first reaction that takes place. Remember that in geriatric patients, it is phase 1 that is affected first. To summarize pharmacokinetics, pharmacokinetics is the study of the movement of drugs in the body. Volume of distribution, clearance, and half-life mathematically describe the movement of a drug in the body. Zero-order elimination refers to elimination that remains at a constant rate irrespective of the amount of drug in the body. First-order kinetics occurs when the rate of elimination is proportional to the drug concentration, such that a constant fraction of a drug is eliminated per unit time. Finally, biotransformation is the metabolic conversion of endogenous and xenobiotic chemicals to more polar, water-soluble compounds to aid excretion from the body. Next, we will take a look at drug naming conventions. In this section, we will provide hints on identifying which class of drugs a drug belongs to by reviewing commonly used drug naming conventions. In general, the drug class may be identified by focusing on the ending of the name, which we will review now for major drug classes. When talking about antimicrobials, antifungals, and antivirals, you want to look at the last part of the name. For example, azole tends to refer to antifungals, such as ketoconazole. Cillin refers to penicillins, and cyclin refers to a class of antibiotics that includes tetracycline. The ending navir, N-A-V-I-R, refers to protease inhibitors such as saquinavir. When looking at the cardiovascular system, drugs that end with the ending olol tend to be beta antagonists, such as atenolol and propranolol. The ending of auxin refers to cardiac glycosides, such as digoxin and digitoxin. And the ending pril is used for ACE inhibitors, such as captopril and enalapril. When talking about anesthetics and sedatives, the ending of ane, A-N-E, refers to inhaled general anesthetics, such as halothane. The ending azepam refers to benzodiazepine sedatives, such as diazepam. The ending of cane, C-A-I-N-E, refers to local anesthetics that include lidocaine and procaine. And the ending of barbital refers to barbiturates, such as phenobarbital. Autonomic drugs may end with terol, T-E-R-O-L, which refers to beta-2 agonists, such as albuterol. Autonomic drugs may also end with zosin, Z-O-S-I-N, referring to alpha-1 antagonists, such as prazosin. Endings of other nervous system drugs include azine, A-Z-I-N-E, for phenothiazines, which are neuroleptic, such as chlorpromazine. They may end with oparidol, which is the butyrophenones, which are also neuroleptic, such as haloperidol. The ending ipramine refers to tricyclic antidepressants, such as imipramine, while the ending tryptoline also refers to tricyclic antidepressants, such as amitriptyline. A few other drug endings to be aware of are afil, A-F-I-L, which includes drugs for erectile dysfunction, such as sildenafil. The ending tidine, T-I-D-I-N-E, refers to H2 antagonists, such as cimetidine, and the ending tropin refers to pituitary hormones, such as somatotropin. In summary, drug naming conventions help identify the class of drug by providing a common ending to the drug name as an identifier. Next, we're going to give you an overview of select drug classes. In this next section, we will review the general properties of select drug classes, including autoicoids, antimicrobials, antineoplastic agents, and immunosuppressants. We begin by talking about autoicoids. The word autoicoid is derived from the Greek words autos, which means self, and eikos, which means relief, and refers to a group of biological factors produced by the body that act locally, rather than being transported through the bloodstream to their site of action. Autoicoids are a diverse group of compounds, including peptides, biogenic amines, prostanoids and their inhibitors, and small molecules such as nitric oxide. Autoicoids are typically characterized by their effects on smooth muscle. Many of these agents act on vascular smooth muscle to alter its tone, thus they will be discussed in greater detail in the tutorial that focuses on the cardiovascular system. Another class of drugs are antimicrobials. Antimicrobials are divided into two categories, bacteriostatic and bactericidal. Bacteriostatic drugs prevent further spread of bacterial infection, while bactericidal drugs kill the bacteria. The classic antibiotics in each class can be remembered with different mnemonics. For bacteriostatic drugs, you can use the mnemonic "We're ecstatic about bacteriostatics" to remember erythromycin, clindamycin, sulfamethoxazole, trimethoprim, tetracyclines, and chloramphenicol. For bactericidal drugs, remember the mnemonic "Very finely proficient at cell murder," which stands for vancomycin, fluoroquinolones, penicillin, aminoglycosides, cephalosporins, and metronidazole. Now we'll talk about anti-neoplastic agents. Most drugs used to fight cancer work on the cell cycle, specifically by slowing or stopping cell division by inhibiting the pathway from nucleotide synthesis to DNA to RNA to protein. Although this will be covered extensively elsewhere in the series, for now it is good to memorize the list of commonly used antineoplastic agents using ABCDEF, which stands for alkylating agents, bleomycin, cisplatin, dactinomycin and doxorubicin, etoposide, and flutamide. Similar to antineoplastic agents, immunosuppressants target actively dividing cells within the body. However, immunosuppressants specifically target the immune system to prevent graft rejection and treat autoimmune disorders. Immunosuppressants include small molecules such as cyclosporin and tacrolimus, antibody-based therapeutics, including muromonab and eculizumab, and recombinant cytokines, including thrombopoietin and interleukin-2 and interferons. Each of these classes of agents is reviewed at length elsewhere in this series. Now, we're going to discuss the pharmacology of the autonomic nervous system. We focus on this topic in this particular tutorial because there is a strong emphasis on autonomic pharmacology in the USMLE Step 1 exam. As a review, the nervous system is divided into the central and peripheral nervous systems. The peripheral nervous system is further divided into the autonomic and somatic systems. The primary difference between the autonomic and somatic nervous system is that the autonomic nervous system consists of two neurons arranged in series, whereas in the somatic system, there is a single motor neuron that connects the central nervous system to the skeletal muscle fiber. The autonomic nervous system conveys all of the outputs from the central nervous system to the rest of the body, except for the motor innervation of skeletal muscle. It is not under direct conscious control and is concerned with visceral functions such as cardiac output, blood flow to the various organs, and digestion. Primarily, it regulates contraction and relaxation of smooth muscle, all exocrine and endocrine secretions, heartbeat, and certain steps in intermediary metabolism, such as glucose utilization. The neurons of the autonomic nervous system can be further divided in two ways, based on either the structural features of the fibers or by the neurotransmitters released by the fibers. The nerves of the autonomic nervous system can also be classified according to the neurotransmitter they release. In this respect, the fibers can be termed as cholinergic, which release acetylcholine, or adrenergic, releasing norepinephrine. Generally speaking, preganglionic neurons are cholinergic. Postganglionic parasympathetic neurons are also cholinergic, but postganglionic sympathetic neurons are adrenergic, although some may be cholinergic. There are essentially two types of acetylcholine receptors. The first are nicotinic receptors. These are ligand-gated sodium-potassium channels. The second type are muscarinic receptors, which are G-protein-coupled receptors that act through second messengers. Direct-acting cholinergic agonists belong to one of the following two groups based upon their chemical structures. 1. Are esters of choline, including acetylcholine, bethanacol, carbachol, and methacholine. 2. Are alkaloids, including nicotine, muscarine, pilocarpine, and lobelin. The classic direct-acting cholinergic agonists include the drugs bethanacol, carbachol, pilocarpine, and methacholine. Bethanacol is used for post-operative and neurogenic ileus and urinary retention due to its ability to activate bowel and bladder smooth muscle. You can remember this action using the phrase, "Bethan, call me to activate your bladder and bowels." Carbachol has similar actions to bethanacol. However, it is applied ocularly, so its actions are restricted to the eye. Carbachol treats the muscarinic-related symptoms of glaucoma, causing papillary contraction and release of intraocular pressure. Pilocarpine stimulates sweat, tears, and saliva, which can be remembered with pile on the sweat and tears. Finally, methacholine is an inhaled muscarinic agonist that acts on airway smooth muscle and is used as a challenge test for asthma. The indirect cholinergic agonists work primarily through the inhibition of acetylcholinesterase. The end result of all indirect agonists is an increase in endogenous levels of acetylcholine, as the body is unable to break down the neurotransmitter once it is released into the synapse. The primary differences in these drugs are in their formulation and their ability to enter the body and cross the blood-brain barrier. Physostigmine is an indirect agonist used in the eyes to treat glaucoma, which can be remembered using PHI is for the eyes. It is also useful for treating atropine overdose because it does cross the blood-brain barrier. Neostigmine is used for post-operative and neurogenic ileus and urinary retention due to its ability to activate bowel and bladder smooth muscle. Neostigmine does not cross the blood-brain barrier, which can be remembered with neo-CNS means no CNS. Edrafonium is a very short-acting drug used to treat myasthenia gravis. Pyridostigmine, on the other hand, is a long-acting drug used to treat myasthenia gravis because it does not cross the blood-brain barrier. Cholinesterase inhibitor poisoning occurs with agents that irreversibly bind cholinesterase, such as parathion and other organophosphates. Poisoning symptoms can be remembered using the mnemonic LESS DUMB, which stands for lacrimation, excitation of skeletal muscle and CNS, sweating, salivation, diarrhea, urination, meiosis, bronchospasm, and bradycardia. Treatment of cholinesterase inhibitor poisoning is twofold. One is atropine, which is a muscarinic antagonist, and two is pralidoxime, a chemical antagonist that will regenerate active cholinesterase. Muscarinic antagonist drugs and their primary actions can be remembered using the phrase inhibits parasympathetic and sweat. Using the first letters of each word in this phrase gets you to ipratropium, pyrenzapine, atropine, and scopolamine. In the CNS, the antimuscarinic benztropine is used to treat Parkinson's disease. This can be remembered using the phrase park my Benz. Now, muscarinic agonists are just one class of drug used to treat glaucoma. Remember that glaucoma is a type of optic neuropathy that results in loss of retinal cells. A primary risk factor for glaucoma is raised intraocular pressure, either through increased aqueous humor secretion or decreased outflow of humor from the eye. The five groups of drugs that treat glaucoma include cholinomimetics, alpha agonists, muscarinic agonists, prostaglandins, and diuretics. These drugs work by either increasing outflow or decreasing secretion of the fluid. Drugs that decrease aqueous humor synthesis due to vasoconstriction include alpha agonists, such as epinephrine, which also causes mydriasis, and brimonidine, which does not cause mydriasis. Keep in mind that epinephrine is rarely used due to its systemic effects and should never be used for closed-angle glaucoma. Beta blockers are also used to decrease aqueous humor synthesis. Beta blockers used for this include timolol, betaxolol, and cartolol. Finally, diuretics may also be used, such as acetazolamide, which decreases aqueous humor secretion through inhibition of carbonic anhydrase. Drugs that increase outflow of aqueous humor include cholinomimetics, such as pilocarpine, carbachol, physostigmine, and ecothiophate. These drugs act on the ciliary muscle and open the trabecular meshwork and have a side effect of miosis. Also, prostaglandin, which is sold as latanoprost. This drug increases outflow of aqueous humor, but may darken the color of the iris through browning. Adrenoceptor agonists are also known as sympathomimetics, since the adrenoceptors are found primarily in the sympathetic system. Selective drugs exist for the four main receptor subtypes of adrenoceptors: alpha-1, alpha-2, beta-1, and beta-2. All sympathomimetics are derived from phenylethylamine. The different substitutions affect the receptor selectivity. Some examples of adrenergic agonists include alpha-1, phenylephrine, and oxymetazoline, alpha-2, clonidine, beta-1, dobutamine, and beta-2, albuterol and terbutaline. The primary applications of a direct-acting sympathomimetics are in the cardiovascular system and the lungs. Specific applications of each drug is reviewed in greater depth in the appropriate organ system tutorial. Indirect-acting sympathomimetics cause the release of catecholamines, such as norepinephrine, that then activate adrenergic receptors, and thus these drugs are called indirect-acting sympathomimetics because they do not themselves act directly on the adrenergic receptors. The classic example is amphetamine, which exerts its effects through the release of catecholamines and is therefore described as an indirect sympathomimetic. Its effects are similar to ephedrine, but it enters the central nervous system more readily, where it produces significant alertness and appetite suppressant effects. Cocaine is a third drug that acts as an indirect sympathomimetic. Sympathoplegic, or sympatholytic drugs act in the sympathetic nervous system and are typically used as antihypertensive therapeutics. The classic sympathoplegics are clonidine and alpha-methyldopa. These drugs are centrally acting alpha-2 agonists that decrease central adrenergic outflow and can be used to treat hypertension. Most adrenoceptor antagonists, or blockers, are either alpha or beta selective. Non-selective alpha antagonists are used to treat pheochromocytoma and can be further classified as reversible, as seen with phentolamine, or non-reversible, such as with phenoxybenzamine. Alpha-1 selective blockers include prazosin, terazosin, and doxazosin, and are used to treat hypertension. Alpha-2 selective blockers include mirtazapine, which is used to treat depression. Beta blockers consist of a long list of drugs that have a variety of uses. What you need to know now is that there are two subtypes of beta receptors, beta 1 and beta 2, that are primarily located in the cardiovascular system and the eye. Beta blockers may be non-selective between beta subtypes, non-selective between alpha and beta receptors, or selective for a subtype of beta receptors. Rather than describe all of these drugs here, they will be discussed in greater detail in their relevant organ system tutorials. To summarize, there are two types of receptors, nicotinic and muscarinic. Cholinergic agonists may be direct or indirect, and sympathetic antagonists include alpha blockers and beta blockers. Now let's test your understanding of the material with a clinical challenge question. A 25-year-old man who is a farm worker develops severe diarrhea, excessive urination, lacrimation, sweating, and salivation, bronchospasm, and bradycardia. Is he most likely to have been exposed to atropine, bethanacol, parathion, or physostigmine? The answer is parathion. Parathion is an organophosphate, and organophosphates are commonly used in agriculture as pesticides. Remember the mnemonic "less dumb" to memorize the symptoms of cholinesterase inhibitor poisoning. Remember, less dumb stands for lacrimation, excitation, sweating, salivation, diarrhea, urination, meiosis, bronchospasm, and bradycardia. Finally, let's review commonly known toxicities and side effects. Please note that a number of agents have specific effects within organ systems. These are reviewed in the USMLE tutorials for those organ systems. We begin by discussing several toxicants that may appear on the USMLE exam. We begin with lead. Lead poisoning is high risk in older houses in which lead paint is now chipping. Children are particularly susceptible since lead tastes sweet, thus encouraging consumption of paint chips by younger children. The symptoms of lead poisoning can be remembered using LEAAAD, lead. LL stands for lead lines on gingiva and on epiphyses of long bones, as seen during x-rays. EE stands for encephalopathy and erythrocyte basophilic stippling. AA stands for abdominal colic and anemia. And D is for dropping of the wrist and foot. The first line of treatment for children is Susamer, which can be remembered using "It sucks to be a kid who eats lead," with SUC, S-U-C, standing for Susamer, and K-S for kids. For adults, the first line of treatment is the chelator EDTA and dimercaprol. Iron toxicity tends to be due to overconsumption of iron-containing food and dietary supplements, which may cause cell death due to lipid peroxidation of membrane lipids. Iron overdose is a leading cause of fatality due to toxicity in children. Symptoms can be distinguished based on the length of exposure, with acute exposure causing gastric bleeding, and chronic exposure leading to metabolic acidosis and scarring that leads to GI obstruction. With alcohol toxicity, the symptoms vary by the type of alcohol. However, for all three alcohols that we will discuss, the active enzyme in the first step of metabolism is always alcohol dehydrogenase. The first is ethylene glycol or antifreeze, which is converted to oxalic acid, which causes acidosis and nephrotoxicity. Methanol, on the other hand, is converted into formaldehyde and formic acid, leading to acidosis and retinal damage. Ethanol toxicity results when alcohol dehydrogenase converts ethanol into acetaldehyde, which causes nausea, vomiting, hypotension, and headache. Acetaldehyde is converted into acetic acid by acetaldehyde dehydrogenase. The drug disulfiram inhibits acetaldehyde dehydrogenase, thereby causing symptoms of acetaldehyde buildup in patients who consume alcohol, and thus disulfiram is used to treat alcoholism through aversion therapy. Toxicity is a common side effect when one drug either induces or inhibits the activity of a cytochrome P450 enzyme that also acts on another drug. Sometimes, the agent can be a food or herbal supplement the patient is ingesting without realizing the potential drug interaction. The most common P450 inducers are quinidine, barbiturates, phenytoin, rifampin, griseosulvin, carbamazepine, and St. John's wort. The cytochrome P450 inhibitors are isoniazid, sulfonamides, cimetidine, ketoconazole, erythromycin, and grapefruit juice. This can be remembered using the phrase, "Inhibitors stop cool kids from eating grapefruit." It is important to note that quinidine is both an inducer and an inhibitor, although it is the induction effect that is more important. Now, some patients are allergic to sulfa-containing drugs, and this list of drugs includes celecoxib, furosemide, thiazides, sulfonylureas, sulfasalazine, and TMP-SMX. Finally, despite their natural origin, patients need to be aware that herbal agents and even foods may have pharmacological actions that can be toxic either alone or in specific combinations with other herbs and/or pharmaceutical agents. Some commonly used herbal treatments, their purported clinical uses, and known toxicities are echinacea. Used to treat the common cold, it may cause GI distress, drowsiness, and headache. Melatonin is used for jet lag and insomnia, but it may also cause sedation, hypoprolactinemia, and suppression of mid-cycle LH. St. John's wort is believed to treat depression, and this natural product is associated with GI distress, P450 induction, and serotonin syndrome when used in conjunction with SSRIs. With kava, K-A-V-A, although it is used to treat chronic anxiety, its use has been linked to hepatotoxicity, phototoxicity, and dermatotoxicity. Finally, with ephedra, it is known to have action similar to epinephrine. The side effects include CNS and cardiovascular stimulation, arrhythmia, stroke, and seizure at high doses. In summary, toxicity can be caused by a wide range of agents, including metals such as lead and iron, alcohol and drugs, and herbal agents. Now let's test your understanding of the material with a clinical challenge question. A 30-year-old man who is an active bodybuilder exhibits metabolic acidosis and GI obstruction. What may be the cause of these symptoms? The answer is consumption of iron-containing supplements. Iron toxicity tends to be due to overconsumption of iron-containing food and dietary supplements, which may cause cell death due to lipid peroxidation of membrane lipids. So to summarize this tutorial, in this tutorial we have learned that pharmacodynamics is the study of what the drug does to the body. Pharmacokinetics is the study of the movement of drugs in the body. Drug naming conventions help identify the class of drug by providing a common ending to the drug name as an identifier. Drugs that act within the autonomic nervous system primarily target cholinergic or sympathetic receptors. And toxicity is caused by a number of agents, including heavy metals, therapeutic drugs, and herbal remedies. Congratulations on completing this tutorial. This tutorial provided a high-level review of pharmacology. For a more in-depth learning experience on this and other medical review topics, please visit www.rapidlearningcenter.com. Thank you.